I'm Mark Feinsand, executive reporter for MLB.com. I had a chance recently to sit down with Mike Hill, the Marlins president of baseball operations, for a wide-ranging interview. We discussed a number of topics, including how his college football career has influenced him in a baseball front office job, what it feels like to hand out a $300 million contract, why he takes an occasional look at his 2003 World Series ring, and what to expect from the 2017 Marlins. Enjoy. You were drafted by the Rangers in 1993, played in the minors for three seasons before joining the Devil Rays front office. At what point did you decide that baseball operations would be your chosen path?
Actually, I think that was always something on my mind. You know, I felt like it was a career path I wanted to take. I thought it was going to be after a 20-year Hall of Fame playing career, it's baseball, so game of adjustments. I battled injuries. I played football in college as well as baseball, so I was a little beat up. So when the opportunity presented itself to join the Rays, Devil Rays at the time, you know, you think long and hard about if it's time to hang up the uniform and hang up the spikes. And I thought with an expansion team, it'd be a great opportunity just to get exposure to every aspect of building a club. And so made the decision to hang up the spikes and jump in with the new expansion team.
Now, you joined Tampa Bay's front office 3 years before the Devil Rays ever played a game. Mm-hmm. What were those early years like working for a team that hadn't yet stepped on the field?
That was what was so awesome about it. I think back to meetings, and I want to say I was the sixth person hired with Chuck Lamar. And so everything was being discussed, you know, philosophy, profile, player profile, you know, affiliate alignment, coaching staffs, things of that nature. There was a draft, a minor league draft in 1996, and we had a rookie league team, and we had a short season team. So there was things in place, at least a structure, an outline of how things would grow leading up to the major league, leading up to the expansion draft and to the major league team. And so a lot of that was being done, and I was right there in the thick of it. Never talking, but always listening to what was going on and listening to, you know, a very, very experienced, knowledgeable group of people and how the vision that they saw for the organization moving forward.
You mentioned that you played football at Harvard. Did you take anything from your football experience that have helped you in this career?
Just the mental toughness part of it. You know, you deal with so much adversity in this game. And I think the front office people, the coaches, the players that deal with it the best, I think have better success in the job. It's it's a lot of adjustments that have to be made. You deal with a lot of failure, a lot of adversity, and your ability to deal with it and overcome it, I think really impacts the success you have in the job.
Your Harvard classmate, Paul DePodesta, has been the chief strategy officer for the Cleveland Browns for the last 14 months. Do you think this could become a trend in the future where executives from one sport move to another, or is he a unique case?
He had experience. He was played football as well. So, you know, I often think had I not gone the baseball path, you know, would I potentially go the football path? Because I still have a lot of friends who work in football. And so it's one of those things where you try to match your skill set with the best, you know, future available. And, you know, if that's something that can carry over to a different sport, then more power to you.
Could you ever see yourself making that kind of jump?
Well, I expect to be in baseball for the rest of my life, so I would say no. But I would say I played the game, and so I have a feel for what it takes, you know, to be successful in that game. So if there was something that led to that, you know, I feel comfortable I could do it.
On the day you were promoted to president of baseball operations, you wore your 2003 championship ring, and you said, quote, I wear it when I want to think about where we need to go, a little reminder for me of what we're working toward. How often do you find yourself looking at that ring and thinking about that?
Very often. It's something that is a source of motivation because all 30 of us, you know, aspire to one thing, and that's to put that ring on. And in 03, we were able to do it. And ever since then, we've been trying to get back there. And, I think every, when one season ends and the new next season begins, it's often when I reflect on the steps that we need to take. Somebody from the office, the steps that we need to take to get there, and so I do it quite often.
When you think back to that 2003 championship run, what stands out the most to you?
We had an incredibly talented group of guys that played together. They were selfless and cared so much about one another. I think that was probably the biggest thing. There was no true superstars. You know, we had Pudge. He's a future Hall of Famer, but there wasn't a true superstar, but it was just a collection of very talented guys that were focused on winning games one day at a time. They had short memories. I mean, we could get blown out one day and come back, and it was all about winning the series and getting better, every day. And that's probably the biggest thing, that it was a very resilient team that did whatever was necessary to win a game and to win a series and ultimately win a championship.
A lot of people who go through those kinds of runs always have a moment that stands out in terms of like, man, that was the best moment of that whole thing. Is there one moment for you that you think back on?
There's a few that I think of. One that I always remember was May 23rd. We were in Cincinnati, and Brad Penny was scheduled to start, and he got the flu and couldn't start, and Tommy Phelps made a spot start, and that was the start, of our run that particular season. We had the best record in baseball from that day moving forward. That's a moment that I remember. Another moment was June 20th, when we called up Cabrera. And that one was interesting because we felt like we needed offense. Hollinsworth, who we had signed, who I had experience with from Colorado, we had given him opportunity to be an everyday player, and it just wasn't clicking, wasn't productive enough, and we needed another bat. And we were looking at the trade market, and we had a number of names that we were looking at, and Miggy at the time was leading the Southern League in Triple Crown categories. And we're like, before we go and block this kid, let's see if he can be the answer for us, because we knew he was an advanced hitter. And so we gave him one day in the outfield. And went like 3 for 4 in the game. We were like, all right, we're going with it. And so that's another moment where, it was just special. And then probably the biggest one where you knew this was a special team, though, was we had a West Coast swing. We went Colorado, San Francisco, and then finished up in Pittsburgh. So
convenient.
It's amazing how they do those 3-city tours. They bring you back. We were neck and neck with the Expos and the Phillies, or the Phillies were who we ended up battling with. The Phillies were playing the Expos, and we had a 1-9 road trip, and the Phillies had a 1-10 trip, and so we gained a half game in the wild card, and you knew that it was just a special year, a special group of guys. Obviously stuff is still on my mind because I can recall it pretty quick.
Say, including the dates,
yeah,
pretty good.
Yeah, and then probably the last one, and it was after that road trip. I used to, and I still carry a portfolio with all of my rosters. We were playing the Expos, and Mike Lowell took a fastball up and in and broke his hand. And we were on the phone before the game was over with the Orioles, and we brought back Jeff Conow, and that was a big move for us, because it showed our team that we were in it, we were behind them, and we were on it. You handle what you guys need to handle, we'll take care of it. the roster, and we had Conan there within a day. And obviously, Mr. Marlin was a big part of that run and getting us over the hump.
In what ways have your views or philosophies towards the game changed since the start of your career to now?
I don't know how much I've changed. I've probably evolved a little bit. You know, it's amazing to think I've been in the front office starting my 23rd, let's see, 5, 3, 8, and 15, for my 23rd season in the front office. You know, I think the biggest thing is, you know, that there's always something to learn, you know, and there's a focus of things that you think are important to help you win ball games. And, you know, it may have been one thing in 1995, but, you know, over the years, analytics and video, and, you know, people are always still such a big part of having the right people and the right voice. Will always be a part of it. The game has changed over those 23 years, and I'd say I've just evolved, you know, to be smart enough to know that I don't have all the answers, and that you know, that you always have to continue to push the envelope and try to learn, because there's always things to learn in this game.
Obviously, there are a lot of baseball people who have influenced you in your career. Are there any people outside of baseball, any other industries or executives from anywhere else who
influence you? I mean, I think we're all students of the game and of success. And, you know, we look at other sports and we look at, you know, trends in other sports. I look at systems in other sports. I'm really good friends with a number of people with the Pittsburgh Steelers and their system and how they build things and how they consecutively or continuously are successful. Similarly with the Patriots and what they've been able to do. So I think we're always mindful of our counterparts and other industries, especially the ones who have success, and look at what they're doing and seeing if there's anything that translates to our sport.
Your mother's Cuban and you speak fluent Spanish. How much does that help in the Miami market?
I think it's helped me throughout my career, not just in Miami. I think our game is global, and over a third of our players are from Latin America. And when you can speak their native language, I think it breaks down barriers, it puts them at ease, it lets them know that you're with them in this process. And I felt that back when I was playing with my Latin teammates. And so the ability to be able to communicate with them in their native tongue, I think just helps break down barriers and helps them feel more comfortable, and hopefully allows them to, you know, to perform because they feel a bigger comfort level.
Your analytics department's only about a year old. How important has that addition been to the franchise?
It's been tremendous. Our senior director of analytics, Jason Paré, a Yale graduate, who as a Harvard graduate I had no problem hiring. That's just how good he is. I think it's one of those things that we had dipped our toe in previously, but we needed to go all in. It's an unbelievable tool. It's a voice that needed to be at the table and a part of our decision-making process. And I think, you know, I've always been one to want to make informed decisions, and to not have that voice and that information, you know, we were lacking. And I think it's made immediate dividends. You know, Don Mattingly and his staff have fully embraced it. You know, every aspect of what we do, baseball operations, is just another piece to give us information to help us make good decisions. So it's something that I'm happy that we went all in on, and we continue to grow with it and continue to incorporate it into everything that we do.
There are those that believe sabermetrics are more important than traditional scouting. Do you think scouting has become less important league-wide, or do you think the importance of analytics is just caught up to the importance of scouting?
I just think we're all in a position where we want information, and I don't think you can ever eliminate the human element. You know, as humans play in this game, so as long as as humans are playing this game, there's going to be a human element that I think you have to have. So it's a blend. Our scouting, our video, our analytics, we use everything. And I just think it's something that's out there and available. And you're foolish if you don't think it's important. But for us, it's not, the end-all, be-all. We still maintain the human element and try to make sure that we have a healthy blend of all elements to help support every decision we make.
MLB's StatCast has introduced some new metrics over the last couple of years. How do you view those, and do you think it's changed the way that fans and teams look at the game?
I think from a team standpoint, it's information that we were already gathering and collecting. I think from a fan standpoint, it's pretty exciting, to see Giancarlo Stanton hit, a ball with 120 mile per hour exit speed, or the things that fans didn't normally have access to. Now that they have access to, just keeps them more engaged and keeps them, excited about our game. And I think that's great for everyone.
You've had managers here that had no big league playing experience, Dan Jennings, and others who played in the majors. And Mike Redmond, now Mattingly. What has big league playing experience had for a manager? Do you think that's a big plus?
I don't know. I think managers come in all shapes and forms. And you look at the managers who've had success. Joe Maddon didn't play in the major leagues. Jim Leland didn't play in the major leagues. But those are guys who've been successful, who just have a passion and a mind for baseball. I think our situation now with Don Mattingly is unique in that we have a superstar, arguably a Hall of Famer in his own right as a player, who's a tremendous field manager. And I think any manager's success, whether he played in the big leagues or not, is his ability to relate with his players and his ability to connect with them and them to hear and know what he's trying to accomplish. And I don't know if you need to have played in the big leagues to do that, because there's guys who haven't, who've been successful at it. But I think you have to have that ability to connect with your players. And Don Mattingly is one who has that ability, who just happens to have been, a tremendous player.
For somebody in your role, how important is your relationship with your manager?
I think it's paramount. I think for me, in a game where there's so many things going on, and so many things that impact the game, ownership, players, the unions, whatever, the media, to have that relationship with your manager and know that you guys can talk about anything and everything as you move forward, just allows me to be more effective in my job. And so for me, that relationship is incredibly important.
There are a lot of rumors, especially in New York, obviously, that the Marlins would consider bringing Alex Rodriguez after he retired or released by the Yankees to make that run of 700 home runs and let the Miami Natives finish out his career in Miami. Was that ever a realistic discussion inside your office, or was that just a lot of hype?
There's so many rumors that fly around this game, and I don't know where it came from, but he retired. It wasn't even, I think I had a press conference and we were talking about something, and we were at a point where we needed help with our roster. So if there was a player available that we felt like could help, we were going to explore it. But it wasn't even, it never even got legs or got traction, because he retired. So it wasn't anything that we had to deal with.
Why didn't Barry Bonds work out as a hitting coach?
I think, Barry is arguably the greatest hitter of all time. When we brought him aboard, we had, great expectations that there, that it would be a situation where he would connect with our players, and it would be, he would be a missing link to help our players get over the hump, because he was such a tremendous hitter, and saw the game just through a different lens. And ultimately, when 2016 ended, we felt like, each of us, that it was just something that, we wanted to try something different. And, and Barry was gracious. I think he put in the work that we asked him to do last year. Offensively, we were a streaky club that had its moments. You know, we led the league in hits and were top five in average, but we were bottom three in Major League Baseball in runs scored. So ultimately, it just came down to trying to find a voice that we felt could connect better. Not that Barry wasn't and isn't extremely talented in what he does, but that we just wanted to try to find a voice that could help us get over the hump with trying to score more runs.
Players have already been very complimentary of Mike Paliarulo as the new hitting coach. What do you think goes into being successful in that position?
You know, you never know what is going to connect with a player. And I think that any coach, be it hitting, pitching, fielding, you have to get that buy-in from them. And, you know we're hopeful, you know, that is the case with Pags, because he does have a lot to offer. You know, former big leaguer, a great process, great routine for our players. And, you know, I think that ability to connect and relate and get buy-in from them is ultimately going to determine your success, you know, as a coach.
How crucial is it for your lineup this season for D. Gordon to revert to his 2015 form?
I don't think our success is dependent on any one person. I think collectively as a group, because it is an incredibly talented group, top to bottom, you look everywhere at the field and we have talent there. I think D is a big part of that, but one thing we preach is that it's not one person that is going to, you know, determine our overall success. It's a collective effort. It's something that, you know, is going to take, you know, probably more than 25 players when you think about the length of a season and the grind of a season and inevitably what happens. You know, we don't know what, but something's coming, that you need depth. And, you know, he is a big part of that and setting the table and doing the things that he's capable of doing to impact the game. But in the end, it's going to take, you know, not just his success. It's going to take, you know, Justin Bour making adjustments versus left-handed pitch, and it's going to take Echeverria buying into his approach. You know, Prado being the pro that he is, and JT Realmuto continuing to grow into a superstar in this game. Giancarlo staying healthy and being, you know, continuing to be productive. Marcell Ozuna giving us a full season of production. Christian Yelich continuing to blossom into a superstar. On top of, you know, our pitching staff keeping us in games and our bullpen doing what we expect them to do. So it's a collective effort. And, you know, I think our guys at Donnie's, under Donnie's leadership are ready and prepared to do what they need to do.
Speaking of Giancarlo, you've done something no other baseball executive has ever done, which is given a player a $300 million contract. How difficult is it to make such an enormous financial commitment to a player, no matter how good you think he is?
I think obviously you have to have ownership involved, because my checkbook is a few digits short of $300 million. But there's a belief in the player, an organizational belief, and when you look at the finances of putting a deal together and where that player is in his career, you know, he's one of the few, and Miggy was one of them also, that they were just to the big league so young that you could talk about a 13-year deal, and at the end of it, the player could still be in their prime.
Right.
And so that was something that we looked at when you look at who he is and his size and his athleticism and how players age and how you think they fit on your club as they age. I think all of those things were a part of the decision to just say, you know, we've let too many players leave and go elsewhere. And we want to try to keep our best player, Marlon, for his entire career.
When you think back to the beginning of your career, and then you think you look at where the numbers have gone with payrolls and salaries, did you ever imagine that the game would grow to the point financially where players are getting nine-figure contracts regularly, and there's a $300 million player.
Yeah, and that's the part where you just need to evolve. I mean, I just look at the major league minimum when I started, and it was a little over $100,000 at the major league minimum.
Right.
And now it's $535,000, and that's in 23 years. So that's something where, you know, as the game changes and revenues and expenses increase, you know, the game evolves, and you just, you know, what we try to do is try to stay on top of what that value is. I mean, it's hard to think when you're talking about those kind of dollars that anyone is ever worth that kind of money, but that's how the game has evolved, and it's up to us, you know, and my counterparts as GMs, to, as the caretakers of the game, to just be mindful of it and stay on top of it and make sure when we're breaking through, you know, it used to be $1 million player was a threshold, and then it was a $5 million, a $10 million, a $15 million, a $20 million, and now you look at Greinke and David Price, and now it's $30 million, and Trout is $30 million, and who knows, you know, where it goes, but it's up to us to make sure that, you know, we're mindful of it and we're doing the appropriate job to assign value and do what we think is in the best interest of the game.
Yeah, the emotional scars from Jose Fernandez's death won't heal for many years, assuming they ever do. But from a pure baseball standpoint, how difficult is it to recover from losing your ace so suddenly?
It is definitely very difficult. There's so few aces in the game to begin with. And I think we really had to take a step back and take a full assessment of our inventory and our assets. And I think when it was all said and done, we looked at the field first and saw that, you know, man, you've got Giancarlo in his prime and Ozuna, who's a first, you know, just coming off a first-time eligible arbitration, you know, a 3+, who's ready to win. Yelich, who's ready to win. Prado, who's a pro. Etch, who's ready to win. All of these guys are right in their sweet spot in terms of ready to win and be championship-caliber players. And then you say, well, you know, you have that core position players that you feel is ready to win. Do you have enough pitching to support that? And our bullpen was a strength for us last year, but as we assessed the free agent starting pitching market and what was accessible, you know, for value, there was more depth and more quality from a bullpen standpoint. So we felt like we could create a competitive starting rotation that could keep us in games, but create a very deep bullpen that we hope could shorten the game and give you an opportunity every day to win a ball game.
Do you see that becoming more of a trend, especially when you look at what teams have done in recent years, what the Royals did, what the Indians did, where, you know, starting pitching is so hard to come by and very expensive when you find good ones, that building a deep, deep bullpen is the way some teams are looking to counter that?
I think it, you know, you can't win without quality starting pitching. So I think that will always, you know, be at the forefront. But I think it'll all depend on a club situation, what their roster construction looks like, their roster makeup. You know, if you have the starting pitch and if you can run horses out there, you're going to run them out there and let them be the starter, the reliever, and the closer.
Right.
That's the best case scenario. But I think we all sort of do a self-assessment of our rosters and what we think is the best way to give us an opportunity to win. And I think you saw it on a shortened version when we got to the playoffs with the Royals and the Indians did with just trying to shorten the game that way. Is it possible to do over the course of 162 games? We're going to find out this year. But I think how we're built, we have the starting options. We have sort of the bridge pieces, which we consider length, a quality length. And then we have five guys who we think can close a game any given night. So it's something that we could sustain. Not sure how long we can sustain it, but in doing that self-assessment of what our strengths were and how, you know, how we look, this is what we feel was the best, you know, way for us to go.
Francona dropped the tape at postseason approach, Andrew Miller will lead the league in innings, right?
Yeah. He may have to throw right-handed.
That's right. Seriously. You have a lot of young players on your roster, but you also have one of the league's oldest in Ichiro. What has he brought to your club since he has arrived here?
Just a tremendous sense of professionalism. And that's something that with Prado, with Ichiro, you want to just show our guys what it means to be a big leaguer and what it means to grind through 162 games, the effort, the preparation, the organization, the routine that you have to put in to be successful. And I think we've seen that with Ichiro, especially through his quest at 3,000 last year. And you just, you know, you hope that that is rubbed off on your guys and they understand what it takes to be a pro and what we have to do individually to prepare ourselves every day to win a ball game.
Some scouts that I've spoken with have tabbed Christian Yelich as a potential breakout performer for 2017. What kind of ceiling do you think he has as a player?
You know, I never try to put limitations on any player. I just know I'm glad we have him and that he just continues to get better and wants to get better and wants to be the best at his craft. And, you know, people say a breakout year for him. I thought last year was a breakout year for him because there's still things that he's discovering. You know, when he hit 20 home runs last year and I think he could have hit 30 just by accident. And with his approach is just that good. He puts himself in a position to be successful every at bat. And I think when you do that, it's inevitable that you're going to put up the numbers to match that.
Social media has given fans a voice beyond traditional sports radio format. Do you guys pay attention at all to what the fans are saying about the team?
You know, we monitor all of that stuff. But for us, it's what those guys in the clubhouse and those four walls, what they believe. And I think that's ultimately what will drive us. I hope that they're picking everybody else to win because, you know, there's belief in that clubhouse and there's talent in that clubhouse. And I think when you marry those two things, special things happen. And that's why we're so excited about, you know, 2017.
Season a few weeks away, what would you say is your team's biggest strength at this point and biggest weakness?
I would say our biggest strength is obviously our position player depth and experience and talent, as well as our bullpen. I think an area that we need to improve is our offense. You know, we have talent, and I've always said that average is talent, but approach is runs. And so we need to improve our approach and how we focus in scoring situations to marry that talent and that approach.
The old cliche is that a season isn't a real success unless you're the last team standing. Do you subscribe to that theory?
Always. We're never happy. We're never pleased unless we're last team standing, and I've got a matching ring to that at 1-03.